Kevin, welcome to Influencers.
Thanks, Phil. Good to be here.
No worries. So you're an Englishman who lives, who works in Brussels and lives in a nearby village.
Yep.
How has that experience of emigrating to a different country and a different culture been for you?
I'm very positive about it. I mean, I've enjoyed my 10 years in Brussels. It is an odd reputation internationally because it's assumed it's a kind of city of bureaucrats and politicians and lobbyists. But, you know, culturally, it's a melting pot of different European cultures, Northern European, a bit of the sort of Dutch, and then the French influence coming up. So Belgium's a really interesting country, which I'm enjoying a lot.
Okay. Now, most people would assume Brussels, just down the road from Amsterdam, not too far, that would be like cycling heaven. But is that really the case?
Belgium is, divided linguistically, divided certainly a little bit politically from time to time. And you know, our two major regions of Wallonia and Flanders have historically followed two different transport paths. The north, Flanders, is one of possibly the bicycling capital of the world, actually, for regions. It's as good as in numbers. It's, at the moment, probably the sporting cycling capital of the world in terms of number of pros per kilometre and that kind of thing, home of other sports. Wallonia, much more car-centric, much hillier, so harder to ride, but is beginning to catch up kind of quite fast. So, and Brussels itself was really, of the European capital cities, one of the worst sort of traffic-congested, difficult places to ride. But for our political work, what you have had under the eyes of the political class is growing from, what we say, using transport geek guard, you know, 0.5% to 5% to 8% to 10, 20% in some hotspots. Cargo bikes are popping up and they're being used by European Union officials to take their kids to kindergarten. And so the city around us has transformed. And that's really accelerated in the kind of COVID period. We have very proactive political leadership in the region. And so it's become, it's probably not quite as flash as Paris at the moment for transformation, but people are coming into Brussels and they're coming in on political visits and going, wow. So as a backdrop to our work, it's extremely useful that it's on the doorstep.
Yeah, and just for the non-geeks in there, those percentages you're referring to?
Yeah, they're mode shares of transport trips. Typically, you know, the States, Australia would have had the 0.5s are kind of your starting points. And then, you know, when you're heading for 20s and 30s, we've only ever seen those in Denmark and in the Netherlands. In any kind of level. So we talk in those bands to give us a kind of perception of what we're seeing in front of us.
And when you travel from your home to your office, are you in that whatever that was, 0.5 and now 5 or 10% yourself, or how do you get
to your office? I live about 25 kilometers from the office. So, and I'm an old Lycra guy. So I will happily put on the Lycra and the bags and bike in and have a shower and it's there. But I can tell you, when I moved to Brussels, I would have a kind of lonely ride through the forest, and there would be me and the deer and a few rabbits, and it was great. I have to say, there's all these pesky cyclists now, a lot of them e-bike assisted, as well as the speed pedelec category, the higher speed, because people in Belgium are increasingly comfortable doing 10, 15, 20K commutes using the e-bike. And it's just extraordinary. It's a really great thing to kind of be part of.
So you say you're comfortable in Lycra. Is that, what's your cycling background yourself? What do you enjoy doing most now?
These days, I mix up with I'm no longer like many people full time in the office. So I am still going to Brussels and I'm using city bikes and I'll grab a bike, share bike. And we're talking here today in Frankfurt. I've been going around Frankfurt on the local bike, share bike that I can just dial up. So that's a good part of my kilometers. And traveling internationally, bike share is my godsend. You know, I turn up in your city and wow, it's just amazing. I can get a bike anywhere in the world for fun. you know, a bit of gravel, bit of lycra, I'll do 100 k's at the weekend with a group of people I ride with in a local club. That's where I grew up. My family cycled. My parents did racing cycling in the 60s when nobody in Britain cycle raced. So I was kind of a bit born to this because I was from a cycling family and a family that was involved in things like local government. So there's been a bit of cycling and politics right from childhood, even though I had a business career for 15 years before I went back into the cycling kind of advocacy world. But yeah, it's always been there.
So it's really in the blood. It's just distant. So Brussels does have a reputation, which you alluded to briefly before, as a bureaucracy,
yeah.
European Parliament, European Commission.
Yeah.
What's it like? You've been a close observer for many years now. What's your experience of it?
I think we've been through several waves of attention. There's a benevolence to cycling, I think, in almost any government anywhere in the world. It's very hard to not be, you know, it's green, it's nice, you can do it with the kids, it's cycle touring, it's all. So you very rarely get like a bad word, but you don't get somebody saying, this is top of my list. And particularly for Brussels, in our work in transportation and even in tourism, the perception is their job was to do the international bit. It was for cities, governments, national governments, and even national governments like in federal countries would say, hands off, local transport's ours. And you guys worry about the, you know, the rules for the single market, or you worry about the international trains and planes. That thinking has almost collapsed, because you know, we will not solve our climate change problems. We would not have had kind of successful kind of health lifestyle changes because we were forced to stay indoors during COVID. We will not get out of Russian oil in Europe unless we actually deal with local transportation, get rid of emissions from cities, those kind of issues. And even the big international travel people, the system can be great to move your truck full of freight from one side of Europe to the other until you pass a city. And then you hit some horrible congestion when you pass the city, and it messes up that system as well. So there is a real move now to tackle urban transportation as a source of emissions, as a source of congestion. And you can't do that without bike. So we've gone from being a slightly noisy irritant shouting for bike to being pretty strategically important. And that's reflected just recently. We've had now have a commitment from the political sphere in Brussels to actually create a European cycling strategy, which is something I've been involved in lobbying for about 15 years. And it was always kind of not quite our job. Now the conversation is, look, we have one for automotive, we have one for shipping, we have one for, yeah, we need one for bike. And secondly, with my job for Cycling Industries Europe, what's the industrial component? Can you bring jobs? Can you bring technologies? Can you bring greening? Can you bring a whole bunch of stuff that we need as a European industrial system? And so we're currently in a 6-month window of helping draft a kind of new plan, new strategy with both an industrial pillar and a mobility pillar. And you know, that would not have happened 3 to 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Individual things were happening, like we could get some money released for tourism infrastructure as part of job development. But to get it packaged in the way it is now is really, you know, I'm very proud of my team and our colleagues and the community, because we've transformed the way the political classes think about us.
So you've been working at it for a long time. You just mentioned 15, but I look back, it's actually about 25 years you've been leading cycling organisations. So Cycling UK, European Cyclists Federation, now Cycling Industries Europe. What would you say are some of your biggest wins or most satisfying moments over all those years?
One could always be, it's a cliche, say, you know, it's the best time of my life sort of thing. But there are moments, and I've said to people, I feel like I spent 23 of the last years training for the last 2 years. It's like an athlete training all year to ride the Tour de France, because certainly when COVID came, there's a toolkit of experiences. And where it differed is that, you know, there have been other recessions, there have been other oil crises, there have been other opportunities. But we weren't represented by people or structures that enabled us to put our best voice forward. And so, you know, when you walk in a room, have you got people that can present an economic argument? Have you got people who can present a social and environmental argument and package it and put numbers? And I think part of what I brought from my business career when I first went into the cycling advocacy world was the sense of that's your toolkit. You know, you would never market a new product without doing some market research. You would never have a sense of what's the potential of the market. And so those kind of disciplines carry through. And those have been the disciplines when you are talking to a major multinational institution like the EU about what's your economic recovery plan? How many jobs can you bring? How many billion euros do you need to invest publicly or privately to deliver that outcome? And that's the sort of toolkit that I've built up, but also surrounded by a brilliant team to really have those answers. And you know, that's been really, really exciting. I mean, there have been great moments historically and things I'm very proud of, particularly in the British scene, some of the wins we had on various topics, both legally and politically. But yeah, I could say it really is, best time is now. This is pretty special, Phil. This is an opportunity to do stuff. And I probably just underpin that. That's also because, for example, at a city level, a city like Paris, when COVID came, why did they deliver 600 kilometres of new bike lanes in 5 or 6 weeks? Because they already had a plan. And all they did is roll forward their 5-year plan. So people who were organised had it ready to run. Those measures were not permanent, they needed fixing, but the people, having a well-organized, structured community, which we know, ready to roll, was all actually part of that success story.
Okay, you've talked about a couple of things there. You've talked about having the data ready, you've talked about planning and so on. You're working at the highest level. You're representing a European-wide body and you speak at global events and so on. For the people involved in advocacy at the next levels down, like the national, the state, and the local grassroots, if you just had to recommend, two or three things that would help make them more effective, what would you recommend?
I actually do quite a lot of coaching of advocates. And one of my jobs I did when I first came to Europe was I'd been coaching in 18 countries of grassroots advocacy groups. And that's so inspirational. But what we were doing is trying to create a toolkit of methodologies. And one of the simple things is a tool called stakeholder mapping. And it's just people standing in a post-it note in a room going, right, well, who do we know? And it's like, okay, my friend's cousin's brother, knows this person. And yeah, but we do have a friendly journalist who rides a bike to work. And we do have that. And then imagining those kind of post-it notes beginning to move, but move in a way where support grows. And sometimes realizing there's a key decision maker in there and you actually have no idea how to move that person. And it gets people thinking, actually, well, we can shout all we like, but ultimately, our job is to move that person's decision. And they might not even know we exist. And so drawing lines of access is one tool we use a lot. And then the other is almost what I said, allude to, is sometimes you are not the solution. What you want today is just not politically viable. No matter how good cycling is, you know, we will concede there's a day, there's a moment, there's a situation, there's a city, there's a politics. And I tell a lovely anecdote of our Italian Citizens Association. Great people, very straight, very good. They were sitting there in the sort of 2010s with Silvio Berlusconi as Prime Minister. And they basically said, our entire strategy is to wait until he's replaced. Because, to be brutal, so we'll work with mayors and we'll work with cities, but at national government level, as long as he's Prime Minister, and then there was a change of political fortune, and they were there and we organised and we'd done some work together, and they started to have conversations with the new political leadership from different parties. And Italy released, you know, 100 million euros of funding for cyclotourism routes, and so things started to happen. But they didn't have what we call a political window. So, and that's true. I think it's true at street level, and it's true at city level. You organise for when the window opens. You organise your coalition, you organise your solution, you organise your media, and you might have five campaigns in your toolkit. And there'll be a day, there'll be a horrible accident if we're being negative. Or there'll be a local storm in the media about congestion. Or, you know, there'll be the politician buys an e-bike and you, right, now's my moment. And that's partly about what we need to do as lobby professionals, is to share that toolkit, but even help build it. And that's why I would say to companies, you know, you need a few people around, just as you would hire, you know, an elite cyclist to win a race for you. You hire the best designer to do your marketing. You're effectively hiring into advocates. Nobody likes being called a lobbyist, but, you know, and we accept that. I don't want to be called a lobbyist, but you're hiring into a toolkit on a set of experiences on how to pull levers, and really that's what we do.
Okay, so we've just talked about the grassroots a little. Let's talk about industry. Now, in particular bike industry, but you can allude to more broadly. But so you used to be the head of the development director, I think, of European Cycling Federation,
yeah.
And Cyclist Federation, and then you set up Cycle Industries Europe.
Yeah.
But you still support the ECF through that. Why did you see it important to set up a new separate organisation for industry?
I mean, the founding purpose of what we then called the Cycling Industry Club in 2011 was because a group of companies, far side companies, felt they weren't doing enough to support grassroots. They just weren't doing enough in Europe to get bike lanes built and get safer conditions. And that's a business interest, of course, because that creates conditions for great sales. But it's not intervening directly in a kind of process that's about the industry. Exciting times. We start with seven companies. We grow to a group of 30, 40 companies. We build up a portfolio of lobbying work. Say we were helping grassroots activists in 18 countries. And that's great. But the more the companies work together, the more we were having other conversations about our technologies, about our business relationships, about how the bicycle business sector needed to evolve and could evolve and could be more impactful. And in all sorts of ways, it's not right nor proper nor appropriate, nor is it good governance to ask a citizens association to sort out your industrial problems. That doesn't mean the citizens association is not doing great work. So when we effectively spun off what was called the Cycling Industry Club, we had a long-standing agreement that says, look, this is not about taking money or industry or support away from the mission of better places to ride in Europe. And in fact, we're expanding it. This year, we're actually moving to provide financial support and logistical support to the mountain bike sector in Europe. Association called IMBA Europe, which is one of the international offshoots of mountain biking. And we're now doing the same thing because we really believe there's a skill set and a resource that the industry cannot have and probably shouldn't have. But equally, we've spent the last 3 years really working on what we call the ecosystem. And there's two parts to that. I mean, actually, the industry in itself does have a role in growing a market that's beyond infrastructure. Access to products, financial accessibility, things like tools like sharing and leasing. What are we doing about the digital layer? People love the idea of looking up a bike on their phone to get one, or they quite like a smartish bike, and in the future maybe bikes will talk to cars and to traffic lights, and there's pilot projects. So there's a whole bunch of stuff that makes for better cycling. But equally, our members want to be as green as the product, you know, and as sustainable as the product. So we should be as proud of our business ecosystem as we are of people riding bikes. People are. There's a belief in bike companies, but there are things you have to do to deliver on that. So we work on sustainability, reliability of our supply chains. You know, we don't want to be embarrassed. And that kind of thing comes with that. So that's the new dimension to our work. And that needs a trade association approach and a kind of industrial think tank approach and data sharing and things you do as an industry.
Well, it seems to be working, that approach, because I think you're up to 100 members now, so it's grown quite a lot. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, we started with 25 in 2019, and we're now cleared. We're happy to welcome our 100th member. And it's interesting the way it changes. I mean, the 100th member is a battery recycling and refurbishment company. You know, it's the kind of new business we would never have seen as part of our industry. And that I really like, and we have about probably 70% of the European bike sharing market as members contributing something very different, doing a lot on cargo bike and other areas. So it's very positive.
So with all these new players, batteries, yeah, bike share that you referred to, what now do you think your potential membership might be now that you're drawing from a broader?
Oh, I mean, I'm told there's 1,500 exhibitors of this year's Eurobike, so why should I be embarrassed about saying all 1,500 should join? But to be honest, joining is more than just collecting the names. Joining is about contribution of expertise. It's about your company being comfortable saying I am part of this, and that I want my brand to be, you know, even some company, do I quite want my brand to be political? Feels uncomfortable in some cultures, in some countries, and not natural. So we're just gradually building up that community of people. And some people, I meet a CEO, a company owner, a president, and they just go, sign me up. You know, it's time that my company was visible in this space. Or another one would just say, actually, it's just about the practicalities. I need to know what the sustainability strategy is for this industry, and I need to be part of it. And I want to be in the room before some legislation or industry standard hits me. So there's a trade of a kind of emotional commitment to the cause, and then there's a brutal practicality about needing to know what's coming.
Yeah, and there have been a lot of upheavals and turmoil for the industry in recent years, and I want to touch on three of them. Mm-hmm. Two of them, I guess you could call more defined events, and one is an ongoing, as they say, existential threat, and those are COVID-19, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and global warming. Mm-hmm. So what, looking at each of those three, you can look at them as a group or individually perhaps, what have been the impacts on cycling in Europe and your industry members of those three?
COVID's, it's not history, but the cycle we've been through is clear and on the record. I guess what's less clear is what we were doing behind the scenes and understand the dynamic. But it's very clear in spring 2020, and the advice we're clearly giving people is don't fight this, don't try and stay open, don't, you know, just this is bigger than us. Where we can, we fight to keep bike shops open, but we will prepare so that when, the phrase I used before, the kind of political window, because we understand there's only so many things governments can do in terms of economic levers. And they are going to need industries that can grow jobs. They're going to need industries that can be in a positive place. They're going to need to know that there are local solutions before international transport needs recover. And I think, I mean, I'm very proud of that component because we got everybody organized. You know, there was a phrase, cycling is essential. Translate it to anyone, but just drop it into every comment, drop it to every, prepare that ground. And then be there, you know, with that political access, with that storytelling. And so behind what people see now, which is sales up, cycle use up, was a really strong kind of political program to place that there. And I think we've learned from doing that. But, you know, we are out of that, in certainly in European terms, in a really good place, because the politicians are looking around and going, who delivered? You wouldn't want to be in cruise ships right now. You wouldn't want to be in aviation. It's tough. And even automotive, it's down a bit, but they're having problems because they've got to electrify. So we look pretty robust. We look like a good bet. And what that has done, going back to early on about confidence and speed and this kind of thing, is when the Russian oil crisis comes, you know, for the first time ever, I've got political officials, civil servants in the commission, phone, you know, as part of our conversation, going, we need you. What have you got? We're going to have to get out of Russia. It's now a policy. We're out of Russian oil in 2 years. A high proportion of that's diesel. We're going to need the cargo bikes. What have you got? And that you get, you know, okay, you're ready to respond, but it's a totally different level of, just, you know, cycling is essential, and it's even more, cycling is so essential, we need you. And so those are very, very much linked. Climate change is hugely important on the European agenda, but some of the climate change work got knocked backwards, inevitably because of COVID. And so the smart political voices are doing the same as us. They're pointing out that everything you do here actually makes the climate change stuff easier. If we're going to get out of fossil fuels, let's just get out of fossil fuels, because we need to do that anyway. So we have a good relationship with some of the key green people and leader of the European Green Deal, and, you know, the narrative on green jobs, and we position ourselves into that. But those three major things in our work are just flowing into each other.
So, cutting to the bottom line, if you like, one of the bottom lines is money. It's measurable.
Yeah.
So how has it looked? Do you keep a tab on the total funding in Europe for, say, cycling infrastructure or whatever? And how are those numbers looking compared to 10 years ago, 5 years ago?
Yeah, we work a lot with the European Cycling Federation. So we have a relationship with them. It's a lot more than funding. It's about intelligence gathering and sharing. And they're doing a lot of the investment tracking for us. And providing that, actually, as part of our kind of think tank work, it's helping companies know where the growth markets might be. But that underlying thing, so we know 1.2 billion was committed to new cycling infrastructure in the second 9 months, the 9 months at the end of 2020. Absolutely counted. But done by grassroots activists, people sending in saying, my city's just announced this. My country's announced this, my government, the EU has announced this, and we could show 1.2 billion, and we can show how many kilometres were created, not just new infrastructure, but fast track, you know, streets closed, bollards put in, those kind of stuff. And so we could track money and kilometres really, really fast. And now we're working to do similar kind of things, and so there was a European COVID recovery fund. We know 1.7 billion euros was given by the European Union to national governments to give to regions and cities, explicitly for cycling.
Wow.
Yeah, and in fact, when they've tried to do programs on the ground, some governments have found that the cycling bit is so much easier to do, they've even increased that. So we just recently heard the Spanish government had put an extra, from their fund, taken an extra 300 million for cycling infrastructure. So that's coming. And we are told that instrument is also going to be the instrument to distribute support funding for getting out of oil. So, well, we, I mean, joking aside, we said to the commission people, we'll just double it. Well, you know, we're not embarrassed, just double it. In fact, more than double it, because you have an instrument. But there are countries that took nothing. I mean, we're in Germany today where I'm talking to you. German government has already put a lot of money aside for support for cycling. Their problem is combination of both engineers and urban planners and political processes. There's money in Germany for cycling infrastructure. They're just blocked. Citizens are riding more. The bike demand is there. It's a great industry here. It's simply, so we're actually, there are other conversations. It's quite simplistic to just throw money at it, but at least we can track what's being released. And we can track what return on investment that should deliver.
Well, that is certainly encouraging figures and trends. So looking at the future, not just money, not just policy, even technology or product, new forms of product and so on. I know you've been speaking about cargo bikes a little, but you take it anywhere you like. What do you think are some of the most exciting developments we're going to be seeing in the next 5 to 10 years?
It's fascinating because I think for a long time, our industry's energy in design, engineering, product, was to some extent driven by sport. And so, you know, great technologies, index gears, things that cascade down to your daily city bike, or they came when mountain biking arrived, this kind of stuff. That's not going to stop, and the passion for those components. But what's really interesting is, and I think most important, is how we re-engineer access to bikes. And by that, I mean that, you know, it's just not realistic if you live in a huge housing block on low income, that no matter what the government does with tax breaks or what we do with the bikes, that you could have an e-bike parked on the street. Yeah, it's going to be stolen, it's going to be damaged, it's not, the life expectancy is not going to be great, even if you could protect it. So what are we going to do on sharing? What are we going to do on digital access? What are we going to do on having a kind of shared cargo bike in every street in Europe? We work with a wonderful company called Cargaroo, and, you know, Jeroen, the founder, talks about, you know, my ambition, he says, is 11 million, because I think there's 11 million streets in Europe where I could put a bike. But underpinning that is bikes to the people. We've actually set our targets based on a number of new people riding. And we say that we think realistically by 2030, our target should be 50 million more Europeans riding. Now, there are not 50 million more Dutch people can ride. There are not 50 million more Danes can ride. They can ride more. It is about the countries where cycling is not currently accessible. And then we should be saying, how do I get a bike in that person's hands? How do I show them that electric assist stops it being sweaty? Stops it being hard. Do I put some digital tools in it? Makes it less scary. And of course, you know, is there a infrastructure between my kid's school and our house, or the park, or on the mountain biking side, we talk about trails close to home. You know, places you can bike to with the kids and play on bikes. So the start with there's 50 million people. And then ask yourself, what do they need? Do they need a bike? Do they need infrastructure? If they're in a work situation, does the bike need to carry a load? And that's where I'm excited, because I've got more and more companies and innovators and new entrants who are innovating on access. They don't always call it that. You know, they tell you, I've got a great product for connectivity, obviously. You know, and I get excited when I think, yeah, I can see how a new person might be inspired to ride. I don't want old gits like me who can't possibly ride anymore. There are enough days in the week, you know, for me to ride anymore. I'd have to retire first, you know. So it is genuinely, you know, my neighbour, who's, you know, we live on a hill, couldn't imagine biking up our hill. And that I think can also unite the whole industry, because we can all unite behind people. And that's really exciting.
Well, Kevin, please don't retire anytime soon. And thanks for being an influencer.
You're very welcome, Phil. Good to talk.